robando a los habitantes del oxígeno para sus pulmones. Se estima que durante la guerra en Indochina, Estados Unidos arrojó desde el aire como 1 millón de toneladas de napalm, una gelatina hecha con gasolina y polvo de aluminio, quemando y asfixiando a cientos de miles de personas. El fotógrafo que captó con su cámara el intenso dolor de la niña recibió el premio Pulitzer por su trabajo, pero el pueblo vietnamita hasta estos días continúa sufriendo los estragos de las químicas como agente naranja arrojadas allí por los aviones norteamericanos. En Bolivia concluyó la cumbre de la Organización de Estados Americanos, aprobando, entre otras cosas, la Carta Social de las Américas, instrumento concebido para complementar los procesos democráticos a través de la reducción de asimetrías y el desarrollo económico. Uno de los temas más delicados abordados en la cumbre fue la petición de Bolivia para que Chile le permita acceso al Océano Pacífico. El canciller David Choquehuanca articuló la argumentación que solidifica la petición de la nación boliviana.
Luego de la ignominiosa guerra de 1879, que Bolivia nunca buscó ni provocó, y de consecuencias imprevisibles, excepto para el que la planificó, un 4 de abril de 1884, Chile impuso una vez más, de manera deliberada, un pacto de tregua y no una paz formal, con la intención de desgastar a Bolivia sometiéndola a una indignante dependencia aduanera para sus exportaciones, que significaron la imposición de condiciones económicas que durante 20 años llevaron a Bolivia a una asfixia económica, hasta verse obligado mi país a suscribir el injusto y impuesto tratado de 1904.
El canciller boliviano concluyó observando que Chile ha lucrado enormemente con la riqueza de la región que quitara por la fuerza a Bolivia, al tiempo que las ganancias producidas por esa riqueza sirven para financiar el militarismo en la región.
Durante años Chile se benefició del guano y del salitre que arrebató de los territorios bolivianos de Atacama. Esa fue la causa de una guerra injusta motivada por la codicia y el deseo de apropiarse de recursos naturales de otro país. Pero no solo fue eso, sino también los yacimientos cupríferos de Chuquicamata, considerados entre los más importantes del mundo y que hasta el presente permiten a Chile ser el mayor productor de este mineral. Lo que un prestigioso presidente chileno demócrata de la década de los 70 llamó, entre comillas, el sueldo de Chile, refiriéndose a los recursos generados por la explotación de cobre que provienen de minas situadas en territorio que fue boliviano y que paradójicamente permite, entre otras cosas, desarrollar una desmesurada carrera armamentista en la región.
Era el canciller boliviano David Choquehuanca hablando durante la cumbre de la Organización de Estados Americanos que concluyó esta semana en Cochabamba, Bolivia. En otras noticias, Estados Unidos prometió este martes entrenamiento para el ejército de Georgia, supuestamente para la defensa de su costa. El anuncio ocurre al tiempo que Washington insiste en derrocar el gobierno de Siria y Rusia se niega a votar a favor del uso de la fuerza contra Damasco, tomando en cuenta el baño de sangre que ocurriera en Libia tras una decisión similar. Rusia sostiene que Georgia inició la guerra de 2008 contra la región separatista de Osetia del Sur y ha advertido a Estados Unidos no fortalecer al ejército georgiano. En otras noticias, en España, casos de robos de bebés y responsables de estos son temas de discusión en los tribunales y en los medios de comunicación. El colectivo Radial Más Voces nos trae los detalles.
En el Estado español, desde los años 60 a 90, miles de bebés fueron robados a sus madres en clínicas y hospitales, muchos de ellos vinculados a órdenes religiosas. Sobre todo, los bebés eran robados a madres solteras, separadas o divorciadas, pobres o, en general, aquellas que consideraban que podían engañar fácilmente. Decían que sus bebés habían fallecido poco después de nacer y en muchos casos les daban un ataúd cerrado para que lo enterraran. Hoy hay miles de denuncias, pero oficialmente solo hay una persona imputada. Se trata de la monja María Gómez Balbuena, imputada por el robo de una bebé hace 30 años. La religiosa se ha negado este jueves a declarar ante el juez de Madrid que lleva el caso. Sor María también está acusada de un delito de falsedad documental. El magistrado la citó después de escuchar el testimonio de María Luisa Torres, que acusa a la monja de quitarle a su hija Pilar, con la que ahora se ha reencontrado. Desde ese momento, hace año y medio, el momento del reencuentro, y el ADN confirmó que eran madre e hija, ellas soñaban con contar al juez que Sor María Gómez Balbuena le robó la niña nada más dar a luz en la clínica Santa Cristina de Madrid y que en 4 minutos pasó de decirle que estaba muerta a que se la iba a dar a una familia francesa. ¿Y después?
Te la voy a quitar porque a esta no la conoces, tienes otra de 2 años y medio que también te la voy a quitar y encima vas a ir a la cárcel por adúltera.
Escuchábamos a María Luisa recordando las palabras que le dijo hace 30 años Sor María Gómez Balbuena. Hoy piden justicia. Escuchamos a Pilar, la hija robada hace 30 años.
Ha hecho mucho daño a muchas familias, que estamos todos sin identidad. Si no lo paga aquí, sé que lo va a pagar arriba.
Las investigaciones continúan, pero el nombre de Sor María Gómez se ha repetido en muchos otros casos de robos de bebés, según anunció el abogado de María Luisa, Guillermo Peña.
Sí parece el principio de la solución de otros casos que pueden haber sido sustancialmente iguales que este.
Los familiares de los niños secuestrados durante el régimen franquista y los primeros años de la democracia entregaron en enero 90.000 firmas a la Fiscalía General del Estado para denunciar el archivo de sus denuncias cuando se cumple un año de su entrega. Piden que se investigue a fondo antes de cerrar los casos. Adelina Ruiz perdió a sus hijas gemelas.
Está la denuncia hecha con todos los papeles que hemos ido recopilando, porque ni en el registro civil hay ninguna información, ni en la maternidad, nada, no nos dan nada.
Manuela, a la que también la dijeron que su hija había muerto, ni siquiera ha podido poner la denuncia. José Francisco es su otro hijo.
Para denunciar tiene que haber un resto o tiene que haber un no resto en un cementerio. Y estamos ahí.
Según David Serra, el abogado de una de las asociaciones, la falta de pruebas es la razón más habitual por la que las fiscalías archivan estos casos.
Nosotros creemos que habría que crear una comisión que quizás sería el canal, el mejor canal para investigar. Aparte de los asuntos que puede investigar Fiscalía.
Las asociaciones piden también que haya un criterio común entre todas las fiscalías y no se archive el caso en función de si la denuncia se presentó en un lugar o en otro. Enrique Vilatorre es el abogado de la asociación SOS Bebés Robados de Cataluña.
Que exista un criterio unificado por parte de todos los fiscales, que no en unos sitios se aplique la prescripción para cerrar el asunto y en otros sitios, sin embargo, se está luchando contra esa prescripción o se dice que los delitos no han prescrito.
El nuevo fiscal general del Estado manifestó su intención de reunirse con las personas afectadas y que analizará la posibilidad de dar una respuesta coordinada. Además, el ministro de Justicia, Alberto Ruiz Gallardón, ha dicho que intentará hacer un censo de los bebés robados. Mientras tanto, miles de madres seguirán clamando por saber dónde están sus hijas e hijos robados.
¡Tumbas vacías! ¡Los niños están vivos! ¡Tumbas vacías!
Así concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Porque necesitamos un sindicato, un movimiento sindical muy fuerte en este país, y no es tan fuerte, ha pedido mucha fuerza y nosotros tenemos que hacer todo lo posible para ayudar a que regrese un movimiento fuerte, un movimiento sindical.
Which radio station's got the guts to play positive stuff?
The People's Radio.
Which radio station's got the guts to stand up?
The People's Radio.
Which radio station's got the guts to be tough?
The People's Radio.
Which radio station's got enough?
The People's Radio, Free Radio, Santa Cruz, on 101.1 FM, freakradio.org.
World Cruise is brought to you by the Association of Micropower Broadcasters. We'll have contact information at the end of the show. Right now, from a concert recorded over 30 years ago, it's Bob Marley and the Wailers, Burning and Lootin'.
That's Captain Fred, but unfortunately that isn't going to be happening at the moment because you are tuned to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. That's the name of my show. I'm Robert Norris. You're listening to a live broadcast on June 7th, 2012. That's right. I got to catch up. And we'll be here for 2 hours. Got some potential phone calls coming in from Keith McHenry, Katzenjammer Keith, as I call him, co-founder of Food Not Bombs. He's been through Santa Cruz a couple of times, one recently when he did a benefit for Santa Cruz 11. Santa Cruz 11, thank you, Keith. And he's going to give us some updates. Philadelphia, as some of you well-educated listeners may know, has implemented a feeding ban, a ban on serving food on the streets, taking a cue from Orlando, Florida, where there was a fight last summer to restore the right to feed, a successful fight, actually, although it actually had some mixed results. But Keith hopefully will be talking about that in about 10 minutes if he calls in on schedule, which is not always a sure thing. Keith is a man who moves about a lot and sometimes gets preoccupied with immediate matters that he's dealing with. Then hopefully at 7:30 we'll have a call from Mark Schwartz, who has told me he is one of the first defendants under the Sit Lie law up in San Francisco, which is a kind of a copycat law, similar in some respects, in most respects, to the Santa Cruz ordinance that makes it illegal to sit down in 95% of the sidewalks in downtown business districts and business districts throughout the city, and as also as part of a sort of a downtown ordinance anti-homeless package, which actually dates pretty far back to 1994 and the elder Mayor Neil Coonerty, when he was mayor of Santa Cruz. Actually, it was the next year when Scott Kennedy was mayor, but Coonerty was kind of the big downtown association pusher of these gentrification, homeless as nigger laws that plague numerous American cities throughout the country now. So those should be two call-ins, one from Mark Schwartz, another from Keith McHenry. We'll see if they actually get down here or call in here. That'll be cool. And I will be covering some upcoming events. I don't know if I have a lot of audio for us tonight, but it will be filled in with appropriate musical interludes so folks can take a breather from what's cooking and do their own cooking, so to speak. Call-in number here is 427-3772-831, 427-3772. You are, of course, tuned to 101.3 FM, a somewhat diminished version of 101.3. We don't have our big transmitter up yet. I don't know if we have it operational. We are trolling for bucks, panhandling on the air big time. So if you got cash, checks, securities, Krugerrands, wampum, you name it, send it our way. FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. FRSC P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz 95061. Or go to freakradio.org, which is the website. If you want to hear us streaming, you should go to TuneIn, browse for TuneIn, and put FRSC into the select space, and you'll find the proper website where we are streaming. So, easy to do. I'm counting on you to do it. Or perhaps you've already done it. That's always likely or possible. Going to begin with a little something to, get us in tune with what's cooking or what isn't cooking. Let's see what we got here. What do we have here? Well, we'll see what we have here.
On the side of a hill, in a land called somewhere, a little boy lies asleep in the earth, while down in the valley a crew war rages, and people forget what a child's life is worth. On the side of the hill, a little cloud weeps and waters the grave with its silent tears, while a soldier cleans and polishes a gun that ended a life at the age of 7 years. And the war rages on in a land called somewhere, and generals order their men and to fight for a cause they've long ago forgotten. While a little cloud weeps on the side of a hill. Heads up the rebels, get back our teddy's hats. Our face and tail are all our own, but our brains are foreign lads. On the outskirts of Europe, in a Glendale so dear, there's a country called Owl Island that looks like a teddy bear. It's an island that's fit into with a bother in our head. Our face and tail are all our own, but our brains are foreign lead. So it's here, Dr. Rebels. Get back our teddy's hats. Our face and tail are all our own, but our brains are foreign lead. Our face is all in Donegal, our brains are in Belfast. Our arms are stretching Galway for our friends that do go past. Our hair is on the North Coast, in Derry and Trundown. I'm sure this head will be better off without the bloody crown. So it's here, Dr. Rebels, get back our teddy's hat. Our face and tail are all our own, for the brains are foreign lads. Our backbone's on the East Coast, from Dublin to Dundalk. Our legs and feet and Kerry, they have shoes that never walked. Our backside from Cork to Wexford, our heart is in Midlands. We're facing towards America with our feet to England. So it's here, Dr. Rebels, get back our teddy's head. Our face and tail are all our own, but our brains are foreign lads. So listen, proud Britannia, to what I say to you. Would you like it if your head was owned by someone quite untrue? And they planted fern flays to mix in with your breed. Before another year had passed, you'd never know your creed. So it's here, Dr. Rebels, get back our teddy's head. Our face and tail are all our own, but our brains are foreign lead. On the outskirts of Europe, in a Glendale so dear, there's a country called Old Ireland that looks like a teddy bear. It's an island that's fit into with a bother in our head. Our face and tail are all our own, but our brains are foreign lead. So it's here, stop the rebels, get back our teddy's head. Our face and tail are all our own, but our brains are foreign lead.
And there you are, your first musical break of the day here on Bathrobe Spears Broadsides. These shows are archived on huffsantacruz.org. In case you get tired of listening to the live show, you can turn to a couple of old shows and bury yourself in the past. Sometimes that can be comforting. And actually, we've got some good interviews, hopefully, ultimately, to be well-indexed so you can know where to go other than simply stab in the dark. Some of the interviews are actually properly indicated, others are lost in the mists, but hopefully someday will be found. Free Radio Santa Cruz is kind of a unique station, at least in this area, in that we air stuff that, you know, KSCO and KUSB and even KZSC can't. I mean, it's not just that we can say fuck and a nigger on the air if we want to, and that it's appropriate to under circumstances, but it's that we can actually discuss taboo topics, raise issues about local political figures that I think might be considered out of bounds elsewhere. At least I do that a lot on my station, or on my show, and this is also my station, and encourage other broadcasters to speak out on these local issues too, because that's the only way we ever get any real motion in education, is to up the level of education, information, and participation, even more important, I think. So, I'm going to kind of give some background on what I hope will be our discussion, some of the discussion with Keith McHenry, who should be calling in shortly. I'm looking online at a story about Houston. Houston and Philadelphia apparently have recently passed feeding bans Philadelphia more recently than Houston. And here's a story from Houston from April. Activists promise to challenge Houston's ban on feeding homeless. And this is in the Raw Story internet website. The Houston City Council voted this week, 2 months ago, to require prior permission before any citizen may distribute food to five or more people on public property. May I breathe? May I help my fellow person? What better check with the bureaucrats first in the Downtown Association? But local activists are preparing to fight back, and hard. While the ordinance passed Wednesday night by an 11-6 vote was drastically stripped down from the version supported by Houston Mayor Annis Parker, activists say they're going to challenge it in court and attempt to gather 20,000 signatures over the next month, which should be enough to trigger a citywide vote on the ordinance in November. And I haven't yet seen much on the net about how successful that campaign is, but I'll be looking. It turns public property into private property. Chris Carmona, civil rights attorney in Houston and volunteer with the charitable group Noah's Kitchen, told Raw Story on Friday. We already have trespassing laws on the books. We have loitering laws. We have littering laws. But to take public property and turn it private, that's our local government's recent mood. That's our biggest concern. The ordinance that passed Wednesday night requires groups to obtain permission from the city before handing out any food and imposes a fine of $500 for anyone who defies the rule. It also allows the city to designate certain organizations as recognized charitable food providers, which would have to adhere to certain rules mostly pertaining to cleanliness. The disjointed groups opposing the city on public food distribution are being led by the local chapter of Food Not Bombs, which boasts that they have been serving Houston's homeless community four nights a week over the last 18 years. They helped lead the charge against the original proposal, which would have required food handlers' licenses and special permits from the city to serve food in a public place. This will make it a crime to pull over to the side of the road and hand out food to five or more people, Nick Cooper, spokesman for Houston Food Not Bombs, told Houston newspaper The Memorial Examiner. Carmona added that his group, Noah's Kitchen, will be restricted to operating at only very specific locations and likely far away from the less seen populations they try to serve. He pointed to the city's wealthier land and business owners as having been influential in the city's thinking on the ordinance, which he claimed essentially says that the city owns all public property. And Randall Callinan, a civil rights attorney who has worked with Occupy Houston, absolutely agrees with Carmona. A few of the downtown moneyed interests have been able to exert their influence to prevent people from giving and sharing food, he told the local Fox affiliate. Callinan and Carmona, along with associated groups, have released petition forms online for distribution across social media, hoping to generate 20,000 signatures required to force the issue onto a citywide ballot this November. I wasn't aware you could do that online. Wow. I don't think you can in California, but I guess I'm not sure how that's being organized. Other groups are reportedly pursuing a restraining order against the ordinance, which would otherwise take effect on July 1st, but Carmona told the Raw Story that may not even be necessary. Under a city charter, if we get our signatures in a timely manner once you submit them to the city secretary, that should stop any action on the ordinance until it can be voted on by the citizens of Houston. And I'm trying to find a bit more on this story from Houston. This, again, is Houston. Activists promise to challenge Houston's ban on feeding the homeless. And we'll see. An interesting thing about this story is it has 121 comments, so it has provoked a lot of discussion online. Hateful, says one person. There's some religious Christian anger about it, quoting from the Bible. What is the matter with Texans? Isn't there a group of Texans significant enough they can stop the clown bus that they have become? I'm always torn by regulations such as this. On the one hand, with more and more people unable to afford food and shelter, food handouts are a necessity, and if the government cannot or will not provide them, someone morally has to do so. On the other hand, I still remember when an unauthorized food giveaway happened when I was a teen, and a whole bunch of people got extremely sick from inadequate sanitation and the prep of the food. Actually, you know, I've been involved in food preps, well, and some food preps and mostly food giveaways for 23, 24 years now. And I guess I've heard of isolated cases of people getting ill, although more cases of people getting ill from places like the Homeless Lack of Services Center meals when they, at different points in the past, but generally not. I mean, no cases of food poisoning that ever reached my attention. And indeed, believe me, if it had happened in Santa Cruz when they were attacking food servers and sending us to jail in 1989 and trying to enjoin us in 1992, or in San Francisco during the period from 1988 to 1996, when over 1,000 people were arrested and I served a month in jail, we would have heard about it big time in the media, which was frequently on the side of the downtown association that wanted to clear away anybody who would make visible or encourage homeless and poor and hungry people to gather and thus indicate that the town was perhaps not as, shall we say, tinsel happy as it wanted to portray, particularly when such gatherings happen in front of the mayor's office and the city administrative buildings. So there's a lot of this kind of attack on food servers does present a lot of popular opposition, you know, and thank God it does. It shows that, well, people can tolerate, you know, murder overseas in a regular fashion and an extending and expansive fashion because the Democrats are doing it. At least even when the Democrats start doing this, these food restrictions and attacks on the homeless in that way, although I guess it's okay to criminalize homeless sitting down, but don't criminalize them eating. That's a little too blatant, sort of the approach in Santa Cruz that's happened. And it happens in other cities, too. You have people raising their voices who wouldn't normally just think it's outrageous, and it offends common morality and common sense. So perhaps Keith McHenry, if I can get that clown to call in, will have more to say about this. And perhaps I can do something to assist in that regard. Let me take another brief musical break and see if I can help things out a bit.
Paisano, preste atención, que otro gallo cantará. Que otro gallo cantará cuando lo libere al pobre, el duende del carnaval. Cuando lo libere al pobre, el duende del carnaval. Mandará, el pobre no callará. El pobre no callará. El mundo será más justo cuando llegue el carnaval. El mundo será más justo cuando llegue el carnaval. Unos días el diablo nos salvará. El diablo nos salvará con la revancha del pobre que es el rojo carnaval. Con la revancha del pobre que es el rojo carnaval. Paisano, preste atención, que otro gallo cantará. Que otro gallo cantará cuando lo libere al pobre, el duende del carnaval. Cuando lo libere al pobre. El duende del carnaval. Sí, señor.
Who says this show isn't bilingual? Fernando Cabral. Anyway, well, I've got a little bit more on the Houston update here, although I haven't gotten too updated, unfortunately, but there is a somewhat more recent article, late April, which talks about Houston feeding ordinance still proves to be divisive issue, and this is your Memorial News website. Though it was passed by a majority of Houston City Council earlier this month, the controversial feeding ordinance is still facing stiff opposition. Around 50 people, among them City Council members Helena Brown and C.O. Bradford, Harris County bondsman and outspoken red light opponent Michael Kibosh, and perennial City Council candidate Michael Griffin, attended a meeting Monday night to get more information on the ordinance and to discuss the direction the opposition should take. This is the kind of thing I like to see, people who from kind of different gadflies and opponents of different things on City Council get together to kind of cut through this and form a coalition, or that's how it sounds. The ordinance requires those wishing to serve food in groups of five or more people to get permission from property owners, regardless of whether the feeding takes place on public or private property. It also introduces a voluntary charitable food provider course, participants which will be designated recognized charitable food services by the city. The intention of the ordinance, as explained by its supporters, is to address problems of littering, food poisoning, and waste. It will make it a misdemeanor to serve food without permission from property owners, which could carry a penalty, as mentioned before, of up to $500. But opponents have long said the ordinance, it violates their rights to freedom of religion, freedom of expression. Nick Cooper, a volunteer with Houston Food Not Bombs, who we quoted before, said it just creates another hurdle for members of the community to get out and feed the hungry. Already we've seen people who haven't eaten for 2 days because people are afraid of the ordinance, Cooper said. He adds that his organization, which serves people in need home-cooked vegetarian meals, has had a horrible time getting permits in other municipalities. I can vouch for that. In San Francisco, where a similar ordinance was passed, 97 volunteers were arrested for violating the law. Actually, that's more like, as I said, 1,200, 1,300 people over the course of 8 years were arrested. I was arrested multiple times myself. A petition to remove the criminalizing aspect of the ordinance has been circulating, but a more extreme measure, that of civil disobedience, was also discussed during Monday night's meeting. Don't comply, said one resident. Do it anyway. Don't let this stem your passion for helping people. If they arrest you, then that's a message. Kibosh said he would bond anyone who was arrested for violating the ordinance at no cost. Still others at Monday's meeting hinted the ordinance could be a rallying point to keep Mayor Anise Parker, who supported the ordinance, from being reelected. The kingdom takes on the attributes of the king, or in this case, the queen, Kibosh said. Later, when talking about the petition drive, he said, if a person signs a petition, they'll probably vote that way. Not everyone was swept up in the political aspect of the meeting. I just want to defeat this thing and go back to cooking potatoes, Cooper said. Maureen Means, who hands out 36 meals a week to homeless people, said she wants to comply with the law and has suggested that some of the people she serves pick up trash after a food service event in exchange for some clothes. I want to be a part of the solution, she said. And that's an article online, again, somewhat more recent, but not that much more recent. Houston feeding ordinance still proves to be a divisive issue. It's too bad we aren't having meetings in Santa Cruz about how to deal with curfews that are impacting people around public buildings, anti-homeless, no sleeping, no sitting laws that are used by police to criminalize people and denude the downtown of people. I suppose it's just one or two passes through the downtown in the last couple of days, but I'm seeing virtually no people sitting on the sidewalks in the middle of beautiful weather. And I'm wondering if this is a function of increased police pressure. And I'm hearing from people secondhand who, for example, attend the Red Church, Calvary Episcopal Church, at the Monday meal. and other interviews I do kind of by the by, that this is because there is police pressure. And on the other hand, it is true, some people, while they complain of occasionally getting ticketed for sleeping, are not getting ticketed every night. But there is a crackdown at certain places, such out at the Midas, former Midas, motor, what is it, the Midas muffler area, muffler shop, now closed. They've run off homeless people from that area and fenced it off. It's near, I think, the McDonald's down on Ocean Street as you head toward the freeway. Little signs like this. I didn't know what to think when I saw they removed the newspaper racks in front of the New Leaf Market because, in a way, theoretically, that should provide more public space for people to sit down. And often there are musical performers on that corner, often harassed by police officers, some of them not so much. So I do know these abominable red give your money to the machines and the system, not to poor homeless people directly, because we want to starve them out and cut them off. That you see downtown, these big kind of red lollipop shaped machines that look like parking meters. There was initially talk that these machines would be create so much anger they would be vandalized, and a number of them were. But I haven't really gotten a report lately on how much money these machines are bringing in and whether they're all operational. But there's a kind of inertia that sets in. Once you put repressive laws on the books, they can be hard to get rid of, or repressive architecture or repressive kind of ways of organizing the downtown city that excludes classes of people and provides a new standard of discrimination against a class of people, then it becomes sort of second nature to people. You know, we don't patronize the shops that have the Jewish star, that sort of thing. And it's a bad thing, a very bad thing. So I read about Houston's feeding ban, and I've also passed on to the Huff website some information about the Philadelphia feeding ban, which, by the way, if you want to get more information like this kind of stuff regularly, these stories, I send them out as well as local activist updates and alerts. If you are a member of the, if you want to join the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website, I should not say website, Yahoo group, and you'll get on the email list is what it is. And just send an email to rnorse3, that's Robert, at hotmail.com. rnorse, that's me, 3, R-N-O-R-S-E, number 3, at Hotmail. We'll put you on and flood you with emails. If there are too many, you can say, help, no, thank you, and, you know, get off. So that's another option for you. So it looks like our man Keith McHenry is... he's either been unable to call in, or the phones are not working, or possibly there is a conspiracy here to keep us from hearing this guy, who's really quite a great speaker and always has lots of information. And most important, he's active, running around feeding people, encouraging people to stand up for their rights, supporting them when they are essentially simply feeding people healthy vegetarian food and helping to organize the basic message of food, not bombs. So, coming up tomorrow, for those who are longtime supporters or perhaps newcomers, the Santa Cruz 11 go back to court, or at least five of us do. The case is now still being pursued against seven of the Santa Cruz 11. I think that two of these, the 11, Cameron Laurendeau and Angel, are going to their preliminary hearing on, I believe it's July 1st or 2nd, must be July 2nd, and that's a couple weeks away. Preliminary hearing is where the prosecution supposedly says, this is what you did and here's the evidence, and then the judge says, aha, and you have enough evidence, we're sending this to a jury trial, or... I guess people could waive a jury trial if they want, but they're smart, they don't. And at the previous preliminary hearings for some of the other Santa Cruz 11 folks, the charges were ultimately all dismissed. And I guess that happened at two preliminary hearings and then what's called a motion to dismiss hearing, where Judge Burdick, Paul Burdick, simply found that prosecutor Rebecca Young simply did not have even, you know, the semblance of enough evidence to take the case to trial and, you know, get past sort of the initial barrier. And she has ignored his ruling in a number of cases and has refiled charges. So five of us, myself, Becky Johnson, Brent Adams, Desiree Foster, and who else? Boy. Anyway, there are five of us. We're going to go to preliminary hearing too, but that date will be set tomorrow. And tomorrow is it's going to be at 8:15 in the morning in Department 6. You'll get to see some character in a bathrobe wandering around. That'll be me indicating my opinion of this entire case and also what I think is really the issue here, which has nothing to do with vandalism. That's one of the charges, felony vandalism, conspiracy to commit felony vandalism, conspiracy to trespass. It's about people who tried to set up a community center and then some of us who were supporters and reporters and observers. Hell, there might even be an organizer involved. I don't know. But this was a nonviolent effort that's been done throughout the country in different places. People have been charged with this kind of stuff, and charges have been dismissed or people have been acquitted. But our courts have dragged this on. Anyway, that's 8:15 tomorrow. It sounds like someone is calling in. Goodness. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yes, hi. Regarding this, these felony
charges?
Prosecutions, I guess you
call it, yeah.
Against the Santa Cruz 11.
It is.
For whoever's decision it was to pursue this, especially against journalists like yourself, Becky Johnson, and activists, it's just so. This decision was either some kind of a punitive, vindictive kind of thing, or just pure stupidity. I mean, you know, anybody who knows Santa Cruz and, you know, hopefully the authorities in Santa Cruz know Santa Cruz that would pursue this are just, like I said, they're either, you know, doing something very sinister that hopefully is not, you know, connected to some kind of, you know, national crackdown. I hope not. But it could be.
You know, that's an interesting point. I mean, I continue to raise that question, though I don't have, you know, I haven't got the memos from the national different police agencies indicating a conspiracy to crack down. But you see this happening in so many cities, in different places. You begin to think, you know, that if they're not getting together to agree in advance, they're taking cues from each other. And it's... It's particularly interesting in Santa Cruz because this activity at the Wells Fargo leased, now vacant and surrounded by barbed wire fence bank, or it's topped with barbed wire anyway, at 75 River Street, which has been vacant for 4 years, and now is, I guess about four, a little bit more than 4 years now. They intended to turn it into a community center, I guess. That was what I'd heard. And there were homeless people who were camped across the way in the San Lorenzo campground, the campground that was, you know, massively depopulated, trampled through with homeless gear, destroyed a week later by the Santa Cruz Police Department. But there's, you know, obviously a need in Santa Cruz for facilities for people. And I guess they wanted to negotiate something with Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo wouldn't do it, and the police, you know, were threatening, and eventually they left. But 2 months later, police, or deputies, I should say, arrested people at their homes. One of them was reporter Becky Johnson. Another was reporter Alex DeRosi. Desiree Foster was arrested. All of us would have been arrested if we hadn't gotten wind of it and rushed down to the court to, you know, sign promises to appear. We hadn't even been told about it. So it seems to me It could be a mechanical kind of thing that, you know, the police and the prosecution are so, they have so much essentially money to throw around in spite of all the budget blather that you hear about and all the, you know, oh, we don't have any money for this, we don't have any money for that, we don't have any money for social services. There is continuing amounts of money for, you know, latest technology for the police, and the prosecution doesn't have to worry about often about taking cases to trial because a very small percentage of cases go to trial. They're plea bargained because people are intimidated. They don't want to risk years in prison, and potentially we could all spend 7 years in prison under these charges.
Yeah, it's really serious, you know? Charges. I mean, and yep. I'm just astounded by the to me, it's just obvious. It's obvious either it's malfeasance or it's but I think it's related to this perverted justice system that we are living under since 9/11
and before. I mean, we've had a class system of justice for, since time began, really. But it's, becomes more obvious when, this is a direct response to people rising up in great numbers, having 24-hour encampments, demanding that banks stop ripping off the town. And then the banks start calling the shots. You know, they're the ones who filed these trespass charges. If Wells Fargo refused to prosecute this stuff, they don't actually actively prosecute. If they refuse to appear in court with a trespass complaint, the whole charge would be dropped because it couldn't go any further.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, if people want to do something about this, in terms of letting Wells Fargo know how you feel about this kind of, attacks on essentially First Amendment activity. And First Amendment activity...
Yeah, I mean, it's also a community response to what is... we know is a serious situation in the world right now, actually.
Yeah, and in the town. I mean, people's homes are being foreclosed on, so...
Yeah, and in the town, it's a community response, and we see the reaction from, the authorities or...
It's true.
But, but with Santa Cruz...
Well, the question is what to do next. See, that's my issue. I mean, it's always, the prosecution and the police are always well organized. They're well paid. They're always on the job doing what they do, I don't entirely disagree with everything they do. But, I'm usually I'm a pretty frequent critic of some of the things that police and the prosecutions do in a lot of different cases. And I think the issue is how can we... turn this around and get some changes.
Or, how can communities regain control of their police?
Yeah, or regain control of their, their lives, their homes, their jobs, their public spaces, all these things. And these
are the questions that are being raised. I mean, that's what Egypt is all about, too. They are looking at themselves. They had a security force that was out of control.
Well, the question is, they were being raised. I hope they will continue to be raised. We are having a benefit for the Santa Cruz 11 on July 1st at India Joe's for those who want to step on down and sample some of his food. We've had a couple benefits there, and it's kind of fun, and people kind of get together. And then we're going to have a protest on July 6th, I believe, a march. And so we're trying to organize some broader statements in the community that demand... let's get back to what we need to do, focusing on the real criminals, the bankster criminals, out of control authorities who are, continuing to pay huge and obscene salaries while other folks are losing their jobs and their homes, or massive attacks on poor people for ridiculous behaviors, life-sustaining behaviors like sleeping or ordinary. Should be constitutionally protected behaviors like being in a public space, sitting your butt down next to a vacant building, which is a crime in Santa Cruz. That's the kind of stuff we want to address. And that, it's a long struggle. It's going to require continued persistence. And
but you guys are, hard. I mean, you are in Santa Cruz. You have many victories. It's just this prosecution stuff that really scares me, and then I know, it takes much more, the Santa Cruz 11 having to deal with this. It's very taxing.
Well, you might say there's a victory when people...
consuming, resource consuming, and yeah. And they know this, and the authorities, which just, you know, which just irks me more, you know. And then, here they are, I'm picking on a Radio Santa Cruz. A Radio Santa Cruz is recognized in... A Radio Free Santa Cruz, or the... A freak radio is recognized by the town council, right there, or something.
Well,
like
I
have been.
It is indeed, and I try not to.
So I'm like,
forgive
okay,
us
well then, and they're picking on one of their journalists, and it's just you know, like so obviously removed from what the community is all about, in my opinion.
Yeah,
and
I
very,
agree.
You know,
I agree.
Yeah.
Well, spread the word, pass on, you know, invite people to come to these different benefits. If anybody's interested, tomorrow at 8:15, we'll be down there shuffling into court, getting another court date, getting another attorney appointed, trying to find out where the discovery doesn't all seem to be there, the evidence that they promised us, all these wonderful videos that show not 11 people going into a building, but 300 people, including council members and so forth. And it's just, you know. Anyway, I've said all this so many times, I sound like a broken record.
Yeah.
I apologize, but thank you for your support.
It's important. It's kind of, you know, something that's like on the, you know, the edge. It's on the, it's very much connected to what's going on, like in the world, you know, I think. I think we are like on the edge of something here, as far as, you know, it's you know, the Occupy movement, the young generation doing things differently, doing things very radically, and you know, I think the main question, the main task is like how we're going to keep the oppression down and keep violence down, and
organize a protest, I'll be there. So you keep me advised about what you're doing. And also experiences that you have that are specific to Santa Cruz. I'd like to know about that. It's easy for you and I to sort of talk about, oh, yeah, it's bad, we hate it, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the more information, the more people stop when a police officer is harassing a poor person on the streets and say, hey, you know, what's going on here? I mean, whenever I see it, I try to draw a crowd over to observe. And it's amazing how suddenly the police tend to try to, you know, shortcut what they're doing. Although, and again, police have gotten pretty arrogant. I appreciate the call.
Big questions. All right. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. And phone lines are open. Who knows? Maybe we get a call from the elusive Keith McHenry. But the line here is 427-3772. And I've got... Food Not Bombs has its own website, and... they did a campaign in April, Food is a Right, Not a Privilege. Sharing food with the hungry is an unregulated act of kindness. According to the foodnotbombs.net website, sharing food arrests could start in Philadelphia tomorrow, Friday, June 8th. And Houston arrests could start in July. This is according to the Food Not Bombs website. There is no right way to give out food. There is only giving out all the food you can. So says Kathy Mitro, who posted a petition online after being threatened with arrest for sharing food in Daytona Beach, Florida, in January 2012. More than 46.4 million Americans have had to rely on food stamps in March 2012, yet many cities are banning the sharing of food with the hungry in public. Many people depend on outdoor meals to survive. Some people report that they've been turned away from local soup kitchens and have not eaten in days. Hunger is also on the increase around the world. Food Not Bombs volunteers and local church groups face arrest in Philadelphia, as mentioned before, starting Friday, June 8th, and so forth. Food Not Bombs volunteers are also being arrested for sharing meals in Minsk and Belarus. Food Not Bombs started to hear of people being threatened with arrests for sharing food in public in January. First from a good-hearted woman, Kathy Mitro, who has stopped donating sandwiches to the hungry in Daytona Beach. Before long, we heard from people in Los Angeles, Santa Monica, Dallas, and Myrtle Beach. The mayor of New York banned home-cooked food meals from all city food programs. Maybe most shocking was the news that mayors of Philadelphia and Houston plan to introduce laws, and actually now have, and they've been passed, that would make the work of Food Not Bombs a crime. We also started to receive the news that our volunteers in Minsk and Belarus were being arrested and pressured by the KGB into becoming informants. And then they organized, Food Not Bombs organized a global day of protest on April 1st, which we actually celebrated here in Santa Cruz, too, with a protest at the town clock, to remind the public and authorities that sharing free food with the hungry in public is an unregulated, or damn well ought to be, an unregulated activity. And I have to say, in Santa Cruz, the police and the city councils have not yet tried again to ban serving free food as they have in the past. And what we see is generally a more sort of subterranean effort where they've criminalized gathering in the parking lots. All the public parking lots in Santa Cruz, it's illegal to have a public meeting there. It's illegal to be actually even sit down in a public parking lot, even in your own vehicle, unless you are actually in the process of parking or retrieving it or walking through. So there are other kind of subsidiary measures that are being used by Santa Cruz under the direction of former Mayor Ryan Coonerty. You're on Free Radio with Robert.
That's good news.
Ah, Uncle Bob, how are you doing?
Without a civil rights component, Take Back Santa Cruz is a neo-fascist glee club.
Well, I've invited them on the air in the past, but, you know, it could be that I have to be more direct and may send Annalisa Cube flowers or possibly candy. I don't know. She and Dexter Cube are the two of the most high-profile leaders of Take Back Santa Cruz, which is... I don't want to say insinuated its way into city agencies and commissions. They've got people essentially on those groups, though. They've had joint, you know, walk-alongs with the Commission for the Prevention of Violence Against Women. They are they're a growing force in Santa Cruz, along with the even stronger Santa Cruz neighbors, as you know, Bob.
You're talking about Annalisa Cube, who is an award winner.
I imagine so. She's a very articulate, angry, and passionate person. Unfortunately, on different sides of issues than I am, for sure. You know.
Well, it's easy to organize, and maybe it's important in one way to organize a community police support. That's not a bad thing. But when you strip out civil rights, you strip out honesty. You strip out anything resembling law, and it becomes a neo-fascist glee club.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's my favorite phrase. I mean, I think it's good work in one sense, but without that sense of civil rights, Robert, it's just a gung-ho glee club.
Well, it's
interesting. You know, cops are never wrong.
Yeah, well, that police officers, you know, it's much easier when the police officer tells you to do this and do that to say, yes, sir, three bags full, than to say, no, but thank you, officer, I appreciate your concern, because you risk, you know, at the very least, ulcers and tension, and at the most, you know, you may be beaten and you may face lethal force or legal repercussions. I ran into a Take Back Santa Cruz guy 2 days ago. We were chatting. I interviewed him about 2 years ago down in the Lower Ocean neighborhood when Take Back Santa Cruz had a sort of a rally, and then there was a sort of a group concerned about Take Back Santa Cruz. I guess the same issues that you and I are concerned about, kind of its attack on the homeless, the right to survive. It's sort of the implication that homeless people are the criminals, or at least campers, illegal campers and panhandlers are some kind of significant social problem. And again, they use the law as their cloak. They say, well, it's illegal to camp, and it's illegal.
There are times, and you and I would agree on certain times, that civil disobedience is called for. And one of the times would have been New Year's Eve 2010.
Mm-hmm.
It called for civil disobedience. And at the same time, New Year's Eve 2010, prior to it, Take Back Santa Cruz, illustrious leader Annalisa Cube, was saying, if you go downtown New Year's Eve and participate, you're thumbing your nose at authority. And if you recall back, there were multiple threats of reprisal from various offices, the police department, the city manager's office, the mayor, Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah, I know. We're not even talking about civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is sort of one of those things that upper middle class white liberals, like perhaps you and I, can choose to do when you walk out of our homes and risk arrest. But,
well, there's a place for it.
But homeless people that is the main target of Take Back Santa Cruz aren't engaging in civil disobedience. They're engaging in life sustaining behaviors that they have no real options not to do, to it
and
to sleep at night,
That's not civil disobedience.
I mean,
there's a place to bring that discussion above board. And what I'm saying, maybe in a roundabout way, is that Take Back Santa Cruz blocks that discussion.
Well, the city council and the gutless politicians block that, as well as the ACLU and all the other groups.
I wanted to ask you, this might make you a little uptight, but what's your position on masks, bandanas, and pseudonyms at protests in Santa Cruz, California?
Yeah, we probably disagree on this. I think given the fact that we've seen that, you set yourself up for a felony prosecution if you walk around, in a public protest under some circumstances, I can understand why some people will wear masks and bandanas, because they feel they have a right to engage in First Amendment activity, and they do not want to have to be in the police files, who are constantly filming and filing away this shit and surveilling you every step of the way, just because they're out there. And I can appreciate that. I don't happen to choose that myself, because I'm sort of an old school person, but I don't criticize them for that at all. I quite understand why they do that. I think you have a different view, though.
I think it runs detrimental to any cause that has honor and merit to run around in a bandana and wear a mask.
I mean, remember that the people in the Boston Tea Party, they dressed up in disguises as Indians and threw tea overboard. They didn't announce, Sam Adams announced he was doing that,
Good for them, Robert, but as I have...
And they weren't dishonorable, I don't think.
As I have raised before, there were 56 signers to the Declaration of Independence, and they used their names.
But that was much later. That was after many people took a lot more risks and got their...
When the Boston massacre happened, there were names, Crispus Attucks and other people that died with their names.
Yeah, but...
There was the one event, the Boston Tea Party, where they wore disguise. Okay, good. Does that justify everything and everybody being masked and pseudonym to death? Well, and I say no.
Well, I don't know about everybody, but I think it's a matter of individual choice. I think
that the movements that make a difference, Occupy Alcatraz, they use their names, Robert. They were willing to take the heat.
Well, Black Panthers used their names, and they got shot dead for it. So,
those are the risks. Those are the risks when you go up against...
Well, it's easy for you to say that, but the question is... You and I are privileged people, Bob. We don't have I think most people use masks, maybe, no, I can't say, because I have not done a survey, really, but... They may feel they don't want to lose their jobs, lose their teaching credentials, lose their, federal benefits. That's something that they shouldn't have to,
They shouldn't be out protesting then, in my opinion.
I don't. I think the more protests, the better.
If you can't stand up as an individual and display yourself in the name of civil disobedience when you think you're right, you shouldn't be there, because it's detrimental.
Yeah, we disagree. I mean, I think you're making a fetish of a particular kind of civil disobedience. I mean,
because I see it. I see it in this town, and I see it not only condoned, but sanctified.
Well, I think...
Okay? I think it needs to be spoken against.
Well, I know you disagree with it, but I think, as I said, I think there are reasons why people do it, and I think there are many roads forward, or what some people call a diversity of tactics. I'm not entirely happy with people who waste their time chatting with Don Lane and John Leopold about this and that, when neither of these individuals, Lane's the mayor of Santa Cruz, Leopold's the supervisor. Lane, was involved with... he had no objections to closing bathrooms in the park, and then claiming and then lamenting the poo-poo that resulted from the closed bathrooms. Leopold, while he talks against foreclosures, has not gone to the county assessor's office and said, do an investigation of Wells Fargo like they did in San Francisco and show the robo-signings. None of that has happened. And so if people wanted to invade in masks or not in masks, I would that they were there at all would be, I think, more important to me. That's all.
I think one of the reasons that the Occupy movement collapsed was because of masks, bandanas, and pseudonyms.
I think the main reason, it was weather, and I think it was also repression by city authorities. They set up curfews. They destroyed structures. They incinerated home and dumped homeless property. They engaged in false arrests with $50,000 bails. And then, of course, months later, they arrested reporters and journalists like myself. So I think,
read about Plessy versus Ferguson this morning.
And that's, of course, that's the cases we know that involved upholding segregation on the trains and the buses.
Right. And this guy was
back in the 1890s.
Way ahead of his time.
John Harlan,
He did what he could to move to Stone. And it's always after the bandwagon that the establishment comes out. They never come out before. Can you name a politician that has ever come out at the head of a social change movement before it was a bandwagon?
You know, I probably could, but I think they're few and far between. And I think, you know, it's often been said to me, you shouldn't expect politicians to do that, because that's not their function. We have a different function. We activists, we choose, for whatever reason, you know, we got dropped on the head as kids or whatever. We have a bee in our bonnets about these issues that just won't let us shut up.
They should be petitioned because it makes a mark. It makes a mark, and there are those that do hear it. And they do hear it, even though they'll slough it off, blow it off. If the issues are sincere, I mean, even you and I disagree on 75 River in some respects, but I don't think we disagree at all with the prosecutorial misconduct on the out end.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate we have to be talking about it at all. That's the problem.
And well, it keeps rolling on, Robert, and the hypocrisy of it all keeps rolling
on. Yeah.
and people don't stand up. That you would think would be comfortable enough in their authority to stand up for a principle.
Well, people don't really know what to do. I mean, for example, there are 300 people who are in that building. And actually, some of them have said, let's all stand up and say, we were in that building too, prosecute us. But most people do not want to do that. They're living on the margins.
As it fell out, the way that they were prosecuted, this was like mid-February for an event that happened late November, early December. 11 were picked out. That were easily picked out by people like Annalisa Cube. I'm not saying she was one of the pickers, but it was that kind of people that said, there's Robert Norris, there's Becky Johnson, there's Brent Adams, et cetera, et cetera. When there were hundreds that were there, or 100, and there's no knowledge of who got the lockbox and the key. They don't know who organized it. It's a sham and a joke.
Yeah, it is.
And
but
it needs to be.
Remember, Bob, the people listening to this show have heard this so many times that I wonder, they're probably turning to light music.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's one of the more important issues of our time.
Well,
the abuse of power that is exemplified by the 75 River prosecutions. And the looking the other way by people that like to call themselves leaders.
Well, on the upside, we have the fact that I guess Steve Plaich is leading a ACLU recruitment drive to change the board composition. Also, we'll be bringing back, I guess, a homeless civil liberties issue. I don't know if it will please you or not. It might be the sleeping ban. It might be
great. I think Plaich is one of the best things that happened to the ACLU Senators chapter.
He's running for city council,
Maybe in 25 years. Okay.
Yeah. Steve right.
Not just Plaich. I think John Alaskin deserves some praise too. But by and large, the ACLU Seneca's chapter has been in the way. They've been effectively a block.
Oh, for sure.
For the community becoming aware of abuse of power.
Well, Bob,
let's
roll with this. And you know, for those interested in talking to some of the Santa Cruz 11, we will be down in court at 8:15 tomorrow morning, gathered in our usual manner, waiting for another court date. And, you know, we need to march on the DA's office and at least make sure that those who've had charges dismissed, they stay dismissed. You see, with a felony, they can recharge you twice. So
you can already see Bob Lee coming out with his PR puff pieces about what a gung-ho law and order guy is.
Yeah.
Right, just to dismiss any attempt to criticize the DA's office.
And we also see the continuing drug war stuff happening. I mean, Ken Sampson's club is shut down, for instance, and now you only have one marijuana club in Santa Cruz City. There's a growing sense of repression that's... I see it all over the state, and I guess, I'm wondering, you know, whether I'm being too gloomy, but let me get on some of this other stuff, Bob, and I thank you for calling in.
Don't gloom.
There you go.
Robert, you take care.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. You are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. Name of the show, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I'm Robert Norse, and we'll be going for another hour. And again, 427-3772 is the call-in number. Philadelphia, charitable group. Well, before we get into that, we have a caller. You are on Free Radio. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling back. Can I say something about the mask issue?
Sure.
Real quick. Just, you know, it's all kind of something that I think about a lot. You know, it's kind of an important thing. My guess is that they're mostly, young people that are doing it. And, you know, I think it's in light of these times, you know, we have to recognize that, you know, young people will feel a bit more against the system, you know, more militantly against the system. It's a very normal thing, I think, in society that to happen, and we have to, you know, recognize and talk about it. I mean, like, I'm not going to wear a mask, and you're not. I mean, we're old guys, you know.
Yeah, it could be. It's somewhat generational. I think it also has to do with...
I think it is.
It's also a form of solidarity of a certain kind. You know, people are doing that together. And also, I think it's an attempt to alter tactics to conform to the new needs of the time, which recognize massive, endless surveillance and the willingness of police agencies to unconstitutionally arrest, brutalize, and prosecute people, even when they know they're going to lose. So apparently, you know, it becomes more difficult for them to do that after the fact if you're wearing a mask, because they can't identify you as easily. And
then when I think about the mask, though, I do think about Martin Luther King, the civil rights.
He wasn't the only
killed, and they didn't have masks.
Yeah, but he wasn't the only person fighting for truth and justice. There's, you know, there are people like Malcolm X and Robert Williams, and there are plenty of people, you know, and Black Panthers who are also. I don't think they wouldn't necessarily wore masks, but you know, people take different tactics, and it's all there's a sort of a greater struggle, which people use different, you know, different approaches, and I think it's wrong to, you know, as I put it, fetishize one particular tactic. I mean, each of us does to some extent what we think is appropriate and right, and unfortunately so many of us are isolated from each other, so we don't you know, the reason, one of the great virtues of Occupy was people stopped feeling isolated. They came out and helped each other. Homeless people started helping house people, vice versa, serving meals 24, and when the police came, they, even these people who aren't, you know, long-term activists who've never done it before, said, no, we have a right to be here, and they went to jail. And suddenly, of course, the police realize, and the prosecution realized, we can't charge all these people. And all the charges against Occupy Santa Cruz were dropped. And there were dozens of phony charges for, you know, lodging, because they were staying with a protest sign overnight. The only people that the police really went after were the isolated people like Gary Johnson, who goes back to court in a week for, you know, sleeping outside with a sign, sleep is not a crime. And it's... you know, I think that masks is one way of, you know, solidarity. It's not, again, it's not my choice, as you say. I don't think you do it. I don't know if you do or not. I don't know who you are. But, I mean, I don't think I would do it. And, but, you know, maybe I'll don a mask to be different. I'll be the lone bathrobed guy, you know.
And just more, you know, and also I've been thinking, you know, in light of Iraq, you know, which is something that I think we are going to really have to keep talking about, that catastrophe of major, you know, proportions. We owe it to the world. Like, I mean, I don't want to, I'm trying to put this in a way that people will understand, hopefully. In light of Iraq, we owe a certain, we owe something to the world. We owe something to the Iraqi people, you know. And
well, the first thing we want to do is stop.
Wear masks, and I'll confront this government and incite it more. You know, that's one thing too that I think about. You know, and that should tell the young people. You know, you don't want to incite this government.
Well, you know, that's true.
Ways, I guess.
Yeah, I understand that argument, but I also think,
you
know, The problem with that is that, you know, it can be used to justify stopping any kind of protest. We don't want to offend them. Don't get them excited. Don't make them. They'll just repress you, and they'll come down even harder. And, I mean, there are some arguments to be made for that, but I generally tend to reject that sort of at hand. Anyway, I appreciate the call back, and be careful. You know, if you're going to don your mask, you let me know. We'll go out and mask together. How's that?
Right. All right. Thanks.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last time I wore a mask. I don't know. Oh, here's a caller. Let's see if... all right, unmask yourself, caller. Who is this?
This is Keith McHenry.
Oh, for God's sake. You're only an hour late, McHenry. What is your problem?
I don't know. I thought I was supposed to call between now and 9.
Yes, silly boy. In any case, I've been reading about Houston and Philadelphia, both from the foodnotbombs.net and also a couple of the articles online. What have you got to say for yourself, Mr. Feeds the Poor Food? But then, or actually, is it poor food, or are you feeding the poor food? What's the story?
Okay, well, I'm trying to feed anybody that wants the food, but I'm trying to do it outside with my friends in public. And it turns out, for some bizarre reason, which I have some ideas about, the government has made these laws in different cities, and I think they probably have different reasons in each city, banning or limiting the sharing of food outside in public. And most recently, we've had such laws in Philadelphia and Houston. And it seems like part of the idea is that, for different, like, for instance, in Philadelphia, they suggested part of the reason of making the law was that they didn't like the kitchen at Occupy Philadelphia. And their claim was that somebody could have been made ill eating at the kitchen at Occupy Philadelphia, although it was kind of strange to suggest that since the food was cooked a block away at a kitchen that they themselves had given a permit to operate at the Friends Meeting House, American Friends Service Committee. So anyway, that was in the beginning of the year, we started getting all these people calling us, or emailing us, saying that they had been threatened with arrest. And it was mostly just like random citizens. But then we started to hear about these laws being passed that, like in Philadelphia or Houston, which were total bans on sharing of free food outside. And we believe, I just got a call from Nick Cooper at Houston Food Not Bombs today that they think they're going to start to enforce that law in July 1st. That's when the law comes into effect. They're not sure whether the police will really arrest them on that day or just come out and serve them or what will happen. We think tomorrow or any time in the next few weeks, we could start to get arrested at any of the three locations where we share food each week in Philadelphia.
Now, are you going to be there yourself, or are you kind of keeping in tabs at a distance? And will you be wearing a mask as you serve food?
Well, I don't usually like to wear a mask. Creeps me out. Mm. And I may go to Houston, in that that's not that far away from here, particularly if that starts to get pretty volatile. I don't think I can make it off. I mean, I'm going to be in the East Coast towards the end of the summer, so if the arrests are still happening then, I might go to Philadelphia.
You're calling from Taos.
I'm kind of burned out on I'm in New Mexico now. Burned out on driving around America.
So you're not coming back to Santa Cruz to regale us with your adventures?
Well, I'd like to sometime, but I typically do that in the spring because of the Anarchist Book Fair in San Francisco that I usually attend in the middle of my West Coast tour.
Now, Florida last year jailed you for, what, 19 days or something? Thereabouts?
Yeah, I did. I did 2 days, starting on June 1st. I was in jail June 1st and June 2nd, got out, like, in the morning of June 3rd, and then I was held again for 17 days, and Yeah, and I think I got jailed. I forget when it was, like early, like about June 22nd, and I got out 17 days later.
And there were many people in Orlando who were similarly jailed, and they started using not just thou shalt not serve food, but they're trespassing in the park or other horse shit of that kind. And then eventually...
Yeah, they would give you a trespassing thing, and there was different fights over that.
But you were able...
Something illegal.
You were able to... eventually forced the mayor to make good on his boast. Oh, you can come down here and serve food at City Hall, right?
Yep, that's what ended up happening. And he dropped all the charges on everyone except for me. The Wednesday before, I had an arraignment, and because I was having to travel from New Mexico back and forth, which was terribly expensive, even though, you know, in and of itself, I ended up getting a plea bargain and had to pay a $1,000 fine.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So,
but, you know, the food law in Orlando still goes, right? People have been constricted into serving at this one location and at City Hall, or are they serving in other places, too, in Orlando?
They occasionally serve at other places, but they don't serve at Lake Eola Park, which was the main bone of contention. Although I suspect over time they could probably even go back there and people will just look the other way, unless it became like a regular fit, you know, unless that became the main place. And it's weird because the place that Lake Eola Park, the actual place that they were sharing food at, that we were getting arrested at, was the place that was built for our large group meals. So they spent like probably thousands of dollars on a area with all these picnic tables and water access and all this stuff. And that's where the government told Food Out Bombs to go share food at. We were actually at the other end of the park, and a ranger said, oh, wow, we've set up a place for you guys over there. Why don't you go over there? So they went, moved over there, and it turned out they were already working on this large group feeding law at that time, but they had not told any, Food Out Bombs about it.
It almost sounds like entrapment. It sounds like they were putting you in a place and they were going to go after you. It sounds like sort of they were running you around, again, creating the illusion, as the authorities tried to do in San Francisco, to persuade the good-hearted liberals that all they needed to do was get the appropriate permits and all would be well.
There's actually an interesting thing. Nick Cooper was reminding me that he wrote an article. There's a thing called Continuum of Care, which is a program that a lot of cities use, usually liberal democratic cities, basically one of the arguments that there was editorials in the Orlando paper when they first started attacking us there, and then also in Houston and in Philadelphia and so on. And it's always, one of the signatures is always in every single op-ed piece explaining why it's not right to feed people outside is Salvation Army. They are always a signature to that. But there's also other mega churches and other food programs, and usually all the food programs or the big ones funded by the local authorities will sign on to the letter. And it basically says that they can provide a so-called continuum of care.
We call it the continuum of carelessness here in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, that's basically what it is.
It's part of the bullshit. It's their 10-year plan to talk about ending homelessness. They're always doing that.
Right. And they send you might have Phoenix and a couple places that have set up a so-called multi-service center, and then you get there as a homeless person, but it turns out, there's one reason or another something can't happen. Maybe if you're lucky, you get a bed at a shelter, something like that. You maybe get job retraining, which is you meet with somebody that then helps you fill out an application to McDonald's, and then hopefully you get the job, but does the job actually pay you enough to get off the street? That's typically not true. And these are the good-hearted efforts that are semi-real. A lot of them are just like, they have no intention, ultimately, of trying to help you find housing or a job or anything like that. It's just essentially a propaganda campaign to give the impression that they're trying to do something when, in fact, they have no desire to do something. And, of course, the problem with Food Not Bombs, from the authorities' point of view, is that we're, instead of it being the problem, like lots of low-income people haven't figured out how to pay their bills, and they don't know how to get a job, and they hadn't encouraged them to rent an apartment. And so it's a matter of either if they get closer to God, they will get an apartment and a job, or if they just do some kind of thing. But certainly the economy is not a problem.
Well, there's always always the army, Keith. I mean, there are good jobs in Afghanistan, as you know.
Yeah, that's one that definitely, sadly, is one of the biggest, one of the way to employ a couple million people is that way. I think that is definitely one of the options that they give you. If you don't like the McDonald's, you can do the infantry, or you could, you know, something like that. Maybe become a prison guard.
Yeah, prison guard's big. I wanted to ask you, though, you've been observing these food laws and anti-food laws when they crop up, and I suppose other anti-homeless laws. I've noticed, certainly, on a number of occasions, they are kind of coincident with the arrival of large conventions, new conference structures, gentrification programs in the downtown. How often is that correlation the case in your perspective?
Yeah, definitely that is frequently. I mean, it's not totally clear if that's 100% of the purpose or reason behind the anti-homeless laws, or if it's part of it actually already thought out. And my experience is that it's actually, you know, part of a larger program where they're going to use, oh, we're building a ballpark over here, so we can't have, you know, we need to move the homeless to some other part of town because they're going to build the ballpark and we don't want anybody to be hurt and blah, blah, blah. Or it'll be like, a famous case was the Olympics in Atlanta, and homeless advocates in Atlanta in 95 were contacting us at the Food Not Bombs gathering in San Francisco saying that they have built a special jail for homeless people. They are making all these anti-homeless laws, and they're cutting funding for soup kitchens that are in the wrong location of town, and they're opening soup kitchens out of town, and all these different programs like that. There was like this little, these people that were building these little huts for the homeless. There was some nice, compassionate people doing that, and those people got attacked, and it was a whole crazy thing. And so we actually did the gathering in Atlanta in 96 during the Olympics just because of this whole anti-homeless campaign that was being organized in conjunction with the Olympics. We're seeing that in Tampa, St. Pete, with the Republican convention. There's definitely been a build-up to drive homeless people and make new laws around central North Carolina in preparation for the Democratic convention. You saw, there was a Food Not Bombs struggles in Denver and Minneapolis to defend the rights of homeless people 4 years ago before those conventions. And
let me ask you,
it's a pattern it's definitely, you have big events or new, they're building new convention halls.
Yeah, I'd love to see a study that kind of, you know, correlates each of those things and then points out where the correlation isn't happening. But we've talked a lot in the last couple of shows when you've been on the air about your struggles to your attempt to encourage people to engage in a reoccupy movement, your movement around occupies in different parts of the country. Is that sort of a thing of the past? What's happening with that? I noticed the word has not come up at all in this conversation until this moment, occupy.
Well, it's a really frustrating thing. I mean, I'm still on the project of trying to encourage people to reoccupy, and I don't know if you've noticed, but there, you know, like Adbusters just put out another statement about the crisis that Occupy is currently in, and suggesting that Occupy is now taking a new form of kind of random temporary occupations all over communities and things like that. But it's a frustrating struggle. I mean, there still are, like, weirdly, some occupations still happening. And I was just in Rockford, Illinois. They just drove away an occupation that had been there for a long time. So it's this weird thing where even the occupation movement itself believes that there's no occupations, but then I continue to come across occupations who believe that they're the only ones still existing. But then you have thing that I've been hearing is that somehow the Black Bloc in Oakland has now finally gotten the occupation movement on the map, and now it's really growing so rapidly because of the several Black Bloc actions that happened in Oakland, but I'm not actually seeing, since the Black Bloc happened, an increase in occupations. It seemed to me that somehow that diverted attention away from kind of what was going on.
Well, I know that, and I know in Oakland.
So it is a frustrating period right now.
Yeah, in Oakland, I mean, something that I've noticed, and I kind of randomly tune into the Indie Bay, or I check it out. There's an Indie Bay news site, indiebay.org/East Bay and /SF San Francisco. I encourage people to check out Indie Media in Santa Cruz for our latest here. But, you know, Oakland juries have been dismissing charges against, bogus charges that were set up against Occupy Oakland people in the past 6 or 8 months. You know, group after group, the Davis Dozen, the Sproul 13, those are people in Berkeley who are being charged. Most of these charges have all been dismissed or people have found not guilty. And of course,
yeah, this morning we just won a case, the Brooklyn Bridge 700 just won their case this morning.
Tell me about that.
In New York City. Essentially, the court, you know, also ruled that it was an illegal mass arrest. And it looks like that case is going to go forward to the point where those people end up getting money. I mean, it's not clear yet, but it's starting to look that way. They're definitely not going to face any criminal charges, and actually it looks like the court events are now more directed at the illegal actions of the police department. That's very similar to what the Sproul Plaza case and the Davis case and so on, where not only do we get off, but it starts to look like we have grounds for suing because of our violations of our civil rights. And I hope that that actually, so well, this is one thing I'm hoping. I'm going to the Buna Bomb World Gathering in Tampa, Florida, as long as it continues to happen. You know, when the 4 years ago, we were infiltrated, a fight developed between two informants, one in Richmond, Buna Bombs, and which was the group that proposed the gathering, and one in the New York City chapter, and it didn't end up happening. They got canceled like a month before the gathering. But there's so much work going on now locally in the Tampa area. I don't think that they will be able to completely get it to stop.
And when is that happening, Keith?
That's the 20th of August to the 26th of August in Tampa, and it's starting to get some pretty major momentum. I'm really amazed at the amount of Put Up Bombs activists. You know, after the NATO protests, you know, a lot of people were focused on that. As soon as those were over, there became a lot of debate, discussion, and plans to go to the RNC, the Republican National Convention in Tampa. And our gathering is before that. And I'm hoping that one of the subjects that we discussed, that's been my proposal, is to encourage reoccupation of public space somehow and to really take that seriously. And today on commondreams.org, there was a top article. It's no longer top anymore, but there was a top article that about is Occupy Wall Street dead, and it did have a connection to the Adbusters. But you know, I think there's been such a. It's interesting. A lot of the blogosphere, you know, around why it's not a good idea to camp out and to have camps have been more from labor and, you know, progressive labor and kind of Democratic Party-oriented groups. And I was even hearing today on Hartman's show, people were emailing in, apparently, to the guest host that, you know, that we shouldn't be doing these kinds of things because it will undermine Obama's possibility of being reelected.
Yeah.
So there definitely is this whole, like, undercurrent. That's part of our big our problem, is that there is this, a lot of people that were as supportive of Occupy, or maybe even really weren't as supportive of Occupy, but now are claiming to be a part of Occupy, are now, you know, encouraging anything but occupying public space. And, you know, I've just noticed a huge trend of that.
Let me ask you.
So there's all these different things happening, but I hope we get to go back. I mean, I think it was so powerful. And when maybe the reoccupation of many plazas now in Egypt will be inspiration for reoccupation in the United
States.
We can
always dream, I guess. But, you know, but you've been you've recently been to Africa, and you've been you know where you wander around, you find yourself getting pursued by, you know, three-decade-old tickets and warrants. What recent adventures have you had that can titillate us and distract us from our misery?
Okay. Well, I went to Ethiopia, and what is fantastic about that is Ethiopia Food Not Bombs. There's actually several chapters that are started up. The one in Addis Ababa, they are doing every week now. That was pretty impressive that they just continued to do it even to today. And it's self-financed and self-organized by the people in Ethiopia. So that is really good. So it's, I think they're on to their fifth week of sharing food without any, you know, without me being there or anything like that to, like, bug them. And so it was interesting to be there because right after I returned, Obama made the announcement that he convinced Monsanto and Cargill to so-called donate resources to end hunger in Ethiopia. Well, turns out what they were doing was donating genetically engineered seeds and chemicals and stuff to some large transnational corporations that would be basically exporting the food out of the country, which is a sad thing. And supposed to be the benefit of the local people was that they got jobs at these agro farms that are principally the U.S., China, Europe, and Saudi Arabia are the main people growing food in Ethiopia, and they're shipping it to, you know, back home, so it's not actually staying in Ethiopia. The other thing that was happening in Ethiopia that was a big discussion was they got their own U.S. drone base in the country, and that now some of the flights that were happening throughout the area where they were killing people for predator drones, reaper stuff, was coming from Ethiopia. And those are two kind of, things that I witnessed or talked to people about. I didn't see the drone bases, but many local people would talk to us about that. And of course, the aid agencies in Ethiopia are super well-funded. They live at the Sheraton Hotel and the Marriott or whatever it was, Hilton, and, you know, drive big, giant vehicles. And people are pretty discouraged to see all this money going to the, you know, people being paid to drive around these big vehicles from USAID and stuff, but not much happening on the ground that was actually happening for people. So,
now you were over there for 2 weeks, and then you came back, and you've been, hanging out in Taos?
I went to NATO. Yeah.
You went to the NATO conference?
Well, no, I went to the protest in NATO. I helped cook with Feed the Peace and the other Food Not Bombs activists.
In Chicago?
And then in Chicago, and then we brought food to all these actions, and then I had this giant banner that I brought out, and we went and protested outside of Boeing, and that march went on like for 6 hours or so. The banner, actually, the photo of it made it in the New York Times. I was kind of shocked about that. And so then after that, I did on the anniversary, 32nd anniversary of Food Not Bombs, I gave a presentation at this church. And then after that, I was a speaker at the Justice Studies Association conference at Loyola University, and I was presented with the Noam Chomsky Award at that event, which is a blue handmade blue bowl with my name on the bottom.
Did you get?
So that was nice.
Did you sleep in your vehicle, or did you get a place to crash for the night?
Well, I got to stay like 3 nights in the dorm, which was really fantastic. That was so cool. Mm-hmm. And being the recipient of the award, I got to have my own dorm room.
Wow.
Myself, yeah. So that was
really
cool.
What about handmaidens and sexual surrogates?
People just don't provide that anymore, the United States.
We're talking with Keith McHenry, co-founder of Food Not Bombs. If people want to call in and ask Keith any questions, because I'm going to cut this fairly short, fairly quickly, because we could be having a report from Mark Schwartz on Measure L and the sit-lie law in San Francisco if he calls in. But,
that's so cool.
But 469-3119 is the number to call, 469-3119. If you have a question for Keith, maybe we can get it to him before he disappears into the Taoist night. What about...
Yeah, I'm trying to still work on this article about the idea that rather than be wrapped up in the details of these criminal cases, like who stood where, when, and all that stuff, the stuff that lawyers usually want you to discuss, or, in fact, you know, like we got the same, when I was in Chicago, a bunch of young people who were making beer got framed by an informant that tried to talk them into making some bomb or something, but turned out they were completely disinterested. And, but they got busted anyway and framed on it, and it became a huge news story, and it was used to bolster the idea that they needed all these riot police everywhere to attack the protests at NATO because we're so dangerous, and anarchist youth, they busted a total of six anarchist youth. Some of them might turn out to be close friends of the local Food Not Bombs activists. They weren't in Food Not Bombs, but they're, local friends. It was a total obvious frame up. Then I met the Cleveland kids. They were upset because the two of the Food Not Bombs kids there were framed on bombing of a bridge on, they arrested on April 30th, and there was big news on May Day. And so there's been all that kind of stuff going on.
The really big question is whether any you or any other Food Not Bombs people have made the select blue ribbon assassination list.
Yeah, we're not. I actually personally did write an email to Obama seeing if I was on the list, but they never responded.
You can't.
Did you see that news today, too, where it might have been a couple of days ago, but I heard about today, where they got emails showing that Obama was telling the healthcare industry that they didn't have to worry that insurance wouldn't be threatened, that there would be no, trying to bulk order drugs through pharmaceutical companies, that there would be no universal health care, there would be no public option, that the pharmaceutical industry and the health industry didn't need to worry that the stuff that Obama, that he was only saying all this pro-universal health care stuff as a...
Election-y tactic, perhaps?
Yeah, and that in reality he was behind them all the way, that they didn't have to worry about universal health care. And it's kind of freaking some people out, because it's like proof positive. It's a lot of documentation showing that Obama administration never had any interest, at least not since they were elected or in the days, months leading up to their election.
The less said about Obama, the better, as far as I'm concerned. We're talking with Keith McHenry, and you get a chance to ask your very own questions. If you have what's your recipe for cooking carrots, or should we even cook carrots? Don't we want to have them nice and crunchy and raw? He's here.
Well, here's another area I'm working on.
Well, before you say that, let me get the number here, 469-3119, 469-3119, if you want to talk to Keith before I unceremoniously cut him off. Go ahead, Keith.
Yeah, well, just the one brief thing, because I should probably do other things too, but I keep running into, I went in Chicago, I went to Humboldt. Those kids are really nice at the Humboldt Park Food Not Bombs, but they were in the center of the park. No one would possibly ever walk by their meal. They had a nice sign that said free food, and it said Food Not Bombs kind of in smaller letters, so at least that was happening. But the people there explained that the same 20 people showed up to the meal, which actually no one ate the meal but the Food Not Bombs people. The people came to get free groceries, which was a wonderful big pile of free groceries. But it was really not, if they had gone two blocks further down the street, there's this plaza where thousands of people were walking by during the time of this meal. They could have reached thousands of people with information about Food Not Bombs or whatever information they wanted to reach them about. No flyers at this meal. I just talked to people from New Orleans Food Not Bombs. They decided that they wouldn't call themselves Food Not Bombs. So they call themselves Community Kitchen. It's a nice name and all. But so I got an 8-year-old or an 8th grader emailed me from Denver. She was doing a book report on Food Not Bombs, and she wrote and said she didn't think the location of the chapter was very good. No one would ever walk by there, talk to them, or see them. That chapter was in the middle, and I've actually been there a lot of times, so I know the scene. They're in Sunken Meadow. There's no possible way a person would ever find them unless they specifically were looking for them. Not a person would ever walk by their location.
So
they have no banner or literature.
Your lament is, and your advice is, get out among the people. Don't hide your light under a bushel or behind a wall or whatever, right?
Right. The larger thing is, you look at this like kill list. You look at Obama bragging that he tried to undermine or did undermine the centrifuges for a short while in Iran. You've got economic crisis throughout the world. Things are real. Scientists today in Nature published a thing about it may be too late to deal with climate change and there are going to be mass extinctions. And these were like pretty sober scientists. So you've got all these crazy things happening, but then Food Not Bombs, who's busily cooking food and sharing it in 1,000 cities of the world or more, their chapters within the United States are missing this amazing opportunity to build a movement and to encourage people into the occupation movement or to resist anti-homeless laws, and all these different things could be happening. But most people actually go by a lot of the Food Not Bombs chapters, assume it's a church, think that God is wonderful and the good thing the Christians are doing this, but they're not making any impact towards changing society.
I catch your drift. Unfortunately,
it's a big urgent.
Yeah, I wish you were talking to a group of people that actually would be paying some. Maybe you are. I know that.
I hope to say this. And if the listeners themselves are not in Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs currently, the thing is that the Food Not Bombs meal with literature and a banner at a good location and a good time can have this incredibly huge impact. So if your goal is mainly Occupy Santa Cruz, but what you are doing between now and Occupy Santa Cruz becoming reemerging in a huge way was doing Food Not Bombs, in an area that's probably going to get you in trouble with the authorities, but will have an impact, because the reason it is getting you in trouble with the authorities is it does have an impact. So I encourage anybody,
Another
Food Not Bombs chapter.
Yeah, you should do it in front of Safeway and do it in areas where people are coming and going, in front of theaters and so forth. And that is something, unfortunately, that Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs doesn't do. But, it's the same problem.
And if it did it, it would be a huge... See, the other thing you hear about is Santa Cruz, I don't know if it's true in Santa Cruz, but you'll talk to people and they go, it's just so hard to get the literature and the banner out there and so on. But if they move to a high visibility location at a time when a lot of people walk by with banner and literature, they would have more volunteers than they could handle, and they could end up doing more meals per week than ever before.
I will pass this message on to the dwindling, or I'm not sure they're dwindling, maybe they're rising, number of Food Not Bombsters here in Santa Cruz. We've been talking with Keith McHenry, or at least listening to him and interrupting him occasionally. He's co-founder of Food Not Bombs, written a new book. What is it, Cooking for Peace?
Hungry for Peace.
If you're too cheap to buy it, it's online. You can read it, but you can also purchase it at foodnotbombs.net. Am I right on that, Keith?
That's exactly right, yeah.
And in the meantime...
You can find out more about the impending or rest or how that's all going. We're encouraging Food Not Bombs chapters and others to organize meals of solidarity in the next week or two in solidarity with the Houston and Philadelphia chapters. And in Belarus. Belarus has been getting hammered by the local authorities. One volunteer was actually locked into the dean's office in one of the universities in Minsk, and the KGB tried to convince that person that they had to be an informant for Food Not Bombs, on Food Not Bombs for the KGB, but that person refused and actually went to the media with the story.
All right,
so,
we're going to leave it there.
Arrested every week there.
We're out of time.
We're
out of space. But Keith, thank you, and You know, you're always welcome to call in any Thursday evening or Sunday, probably for a shorter but still more important and pointed analysis and update, man.
Okay, well, we'll do that then. Thanks. Have fun.
Thank you, Keith. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And phone lines are open, hopefully, 427-3772. That was Keith McHenry. He may have ousted the Measure L, I should say, defendant up in San Francisco. Measure L is the sit lie law up there, the San Francisco version of the sit on the sidewalk, go to jail, because we don't want you scumbags sitting around in our town. And I don't know if we're actually going to get him in, because I think, because Keith went over, he may have become discouraged. But who knows? Eventually we will. I will continue kind of bringing up a few items. I am, in fact, going back to court on another issue where actually I am the complainant and the city is the defendant. That's the famous mock Nazi salute, what I call the city council repression case, also known as the Heil-Krohn case, because Mayor Christopher Krohn was the individual who arrested me for a brief mock Nazi silent salute in response to his cracking down at city council on speakers and threatening to arrest them and cutting back on their time. That was 10 years ago. Anyway, we've sued the city. We've sued two mayors. We've tried to go to trial twice. It's been thwarted by a authority-loving judge, I guess. His name is Robert White. That's gone up to the Supreme Court and back. And now we go to trial again. That we're going to be doing is a what appears to be a preliminary hearing about a week and a day from today. I think it's a week from tomorrow, Friday, is the hearing in San Jose. I'll be announcing it in more detail, more specifically, on Sunday. Maybe I'll get an interview with attorney David Beauvais, who's the attorney on this case. And you'll be hearing more about it. That's coming up. Another thing that's coming up next Thursday, a week from today, is Ed Fry and Gary Johnson, activists who were charged with essentially First Amendment and survival camping activity outside the courthouse 2 years ago with Peace Camp 2010. They've appealed their convictions under the 647E state lodging law, catch-all statute, unconstitutionally vague and broad, both, which has been used by Judge John Gallagher, Grim Gavel Gallagher, as I like to call him, to convict them and sway the jury with, again, the preposterous notion that the state can arrest anyone at any time for sitting down for a so-called lodging in an area, particularly venomous against homeless people, because when they are sitting down for longer periods of time, as they do need to rest and they need to sleep, need to cover up with protective clothing, that does certainly gives the appearance of temporarily living in a place, even if it's not their abode. They don't intend to be there forever. They're there temporarily. That becomes the basis for sending them to jail for up to 6 months. And both Gary Johnson and Ed Fry, his attorney, who was not just his attorney, but someone who was out there with him, sleeping outside with homeless people, protesting the sleeping ban, the city code that makes it illegal for homeless people to sleep. 640, it was 6.36.010A and B and C. And that's coming up at 4 o'clock in Department 5 next Thursday. That will be Thursday the 14th. So I'll be talking about that on Sunday as well. Encourage people to go check that one out. And I will probably be there, bathrobed and ready to fall asleep if things get too boring. Or I had stories about Philadelphia and its feeding ban, which I've read a little bit about in the past. Charitable group offers to pay your fines if you ignore Philly's new ban on feeding the homeless. This is a story on TheBlaze.com. Philadelphia's new law banning all outdoor feedings of large numbers of people on city parkland goes into effect Friday, according to CBS Philly, and some charitable groups have elected to ignore it. That would be tomorrow it goes into effect. I encourage every church, every organization, every individual that has been serving on the parkway to continue serving on the parkway despite the law that is going into effect, said Altrus Boatwright, operations manager for Chosen 300, a charitable organization which has proudly served Philadelphia's homeless community for years with outdoor feedings. But why would the city pass a ban on charitable giving? According to proponents of the bill, including Philadelphia's Mayor Michael Nutter, that is in fact his name, the new law will, quote, protect the dignity of the homeless, cleanliness of the parks, and eliminate food health concerns. However, dozens of opponents of the law testified at a hearing on Thursday and said the reasoning behind the ban was bunko. These regulations are clearly designated not with the intent of protecting the health and dignity of the homeless, but are designed to tuck the homeless in a corner and pretend that the problem does not exist in our city, Reverend Brian Jenkins of Chosen 300 Ministries said. The group has established a fund to help anyone fined for breaking the outdoor feeding ban. Philly.com reports, the people are the number one resources of the city, notes not the Barnes Museum, said Philadelphia homeless advocate Eric Young. Feeding people and serving the needs of the people is a fundamental right, and to ban it or oppose it and not to work to solve this problem is unconstitutional and inhumane. Another story, the law banning all outdoor feedings of large numbers of people in Sandy Parkland went into effect on Friday. And actually, this is more of the same. Looks like this is. Students from the Mathematics, Civics, and Sciences Charter School testified about their weekly feedings on the parkway. They said the students raised $500 to $1,000 each week for food and toiletries for hundreds of homeless near Ben Franklin Parkway. The food we distribute is prepared in our school cafeteria in the same manner and under the same conditions as the food that is served to the students, said Gregory Dooley. It is clear to me that the reason the mayor has implemented this new directive is that he does not like the way large groups of homeless people and the public looks to visitors and more affluent residents. The ban applies to the Fairmont Park system, which includes Love Park and the Ben Franklin Parkway. The Nutter administration did not attend the hearing. Philadelphia's ban on serving food to the hungry and reactions, even among religious groups that hand out meals, are mixed. Jay Babieri, an elder at the Liberty Church at the Fairmont neighborhood, said parishioners have been instructed to comply with the city's ban, but in letter only. We've asked our people to think of ways they might comply, but not comply, Barbieri said. Aha, diversity of tactics. Ideas have included standing in the street where your car is parked and handing out bagged lunches that would then comply because we're not standing in Fairmont Park. Barbieri said they've also considered asking to use private parking lots near Logan Square. Others are following the spirit of the law and moving to serve meals indoors, where the city hopes the hungry will be more likely to get social services and support in addition to food. Irene McFadden with Christ Memorial Lutheran Church in Malvern recently stopped serving food in Love Park. Volunteers moved to borrowed space at Broad Street Ministries, which opened its doors to groups looking for places to serve inside. We didn't want to be civilly disobedient. We felt that we would be the wrong message for us as Christians to break the law. She said, doesn't know much about the history of Christianity. So we sought to find a way to work within the confines of the system, McFadden said. A city spokesman said three groups of served meals on the designated area outside City Hall where hand-washing stations and toilet facilities are provided and passing out food is allowed. Groups violating the ban will be given two warnings before they are issued a $150 fine. Philadelphia sued over ban on serving meals to homeless outdoors. The City of Philadelphia and Mayor Michael Nutter are now facing a lawsuit over the mayor's recently introduced ban on outdoor feeding in city parks. The suit was filed this morning. This was, I guess, June 5th. There we go. Well, not sure exactly when it was. Early June. On behalf of various groups and individuals who have been serving meals to the homeless on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway for years. The plaintiffs are being represented by Paul Messing of the Center Law Firm Cares, Radofsky, Messing, and Feinberg, which specializes in civil rights litigation, as well as the American Civil Liberties Union, and attorney Seth Kreimer. It's been 2 months since Nutter announced a ban on the serving of meals outdoors in city parks. While the ban theoretically applies to the entire city, it was widely understood to target the serving of meals on the parkway, which has been a site for that activity for more than 10 years, and which has also been the focus of an attempted revival by the city, spearheaded by the opening last month of the Barnes Museum. Nutter isn't the first Philadelphia mayor to try and curtail similar activity. Mayors John Street and Ed Rendell faced opposition to various efforts to curb the presence of homeless people on the parkway and nearby in Center City. The mayor is, however, the first to impose an outright ban on the serving of meals outdoors. Today's suit, filed in the U.S. District Court, Eastern District of Pennsylvania, alleges that the mayor's ban, introduced as an administrative rule and which thus did not pass through City Council, sort of similar to the curfew at the courthouse, which didn't pass through the Board of Supervisors, or the curfew at City Hall after dark, which doesn't allow you to sit with a sign at night in front of City Hall, which didn't pass through the City Council, is in violation of state and federal law on three counts. According to the suit, the Philadelphia feeding ban violates the First and Fourteenth Amendment rights of plaintiffs, many of whom believe it is their religious duty to serve such meals by depriving them of their rights of the free exercise of religion. It violates the First and Fourteenth Amendment rights of the plaintiffs by denying them their freedom of speech, the argument being that serving of meals is itself a form of expression. And it violates the Pennsylvania Religious Freedom Protection Act, which guarantees Pennsylvania residents the right to free exercise of religion. The lawsuit asks for a judgment that the ban is unconstitutional and seeks an injunction against the city to bar it from preventing the plaintiffs from serving meals. We'll have more details soon, so stay tuned here at Naked City. I think what I'm going to do right now is try to get in touch with our own legal eagle, Stephen Plaich, who was in court this morning, whooping it up, and perhaps he will have some word about his own lawsuit, which he was defending, where he was defending the rights of himself as an Occupy Santa Cruz person when the city attorney went after him with his law books, his lawyers, and his money.
This is Steve Plaich.
Steve Plaich, Free Radio calling in. You have a brief period of time. We understand that you are stalking the courts today. Can you give us an update?
Well, we have the two companion matters going on. One was our Occupy lawsuit against the police chief in the city of Santa Cruz, and that was dismissed today because we really didn't have any reason to pursue that. The other matter was the city of Santa Cruz versus Occupy, and then the city of Santa Cruz versus me personally. And there will be a motion to be filed, to be heard July 26th, to kind of revive that case, and then we'll move forward to trial maybe late summer, early fall.
Well, that's a lot of legal gobbledygook, Plaich. Put that into plain English for us, will you, the suit that's coming up?
Well, we're going to get our day in court for Occupy San Lorenzo Park. As you know, that camp, which we had for 2 months down at San Lorenzo Park, as well as our occupation of the courthouse steps, the camp was dismantled for order of the city in December, early December, December 2nd or 3rd, I think. We had gone to court to try to get that order enjoined and successfully, but now we're going to be back before Judge Volkman to determine that matter in a court of law and see if we can get some justice for the occupiers.
Well, what's the significance now that nary a soul is sleeping in that area at night that I've seen, although I haven't been down there? Have you been noticing any kind of surreptitious reoccupiers sleeping out there?
No, but I think the question is, you know, whether or not that is, as a matter of law, a traditional public forum, whether or not what we were doing there was really our First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and freedom assembly. But more than that, I think that the occupation was accused of being a public nuisance by the city, and I think we have an opportunity to get a finding of fact from the court through the examination of witnesses, the high and the mighty, and the low and the meek, for Santa Cruz city officials to determine that no, that was not a public nuisance, but rather was public benefit, because we were sheltering and feeding upwards of 100 or 120 homeless folks who otherwise would have gone hungry and unsheltered in Santa Cruz for that two-month period.
Any reports from the Homeless Lack of Services Center, where you have a Friday morning Homeless Legal Assistance Project as well as a Monday evening presence where you are hanging out at the bagel table, but also presumably available for people to bring their tickets and legal problems to you at the Red Church between 5 and 7 at Calvary Episcopal?
Yes, we have the legal services there. We combine that with our OccuBagel service, Mel Nunez and myself, as you know. But my understanding is I'll be up at the Homeless Service Center tomorrow doing the homeless legal assistance. And last week I did learn that there is a new kind of site supervisor there, Sheila, and my person I got the information from, couldn't recall her last name, but I'm hoping to be able to meet her tomorrow. As you know, Leticia Schwartz and Daniel White have moved on, and Nancy Lubiscotti, I think, is still on kind of an extended leave. So there's a bit of a staff reorganization up there, so I'm hoping to be able to talk to this new person that they hired on, and see what the lay of the land is up there.
So are you going to attempt a coup in yourself to establish a more democratic, open regime at the Homeless Lack of Services Center?
Well, that's always my intention, but, sometimes it doesn't work out that way. We did have an interesting discussion. As you know, I'm a member of the Association of Faith Communities. We're trying to get some traction on homelessness and homeless services, and Don Lane was there talking about tonight his opinion of the 8 or 9 point proposed initiatives that have been put forth by the ad hoc committee and council members, community, Robinson and Bryant. So we had a discussion about that.
Sorry, say that again, Steve.
We just had a discussion amongst the group about what our reaction was to those proposed policy changes. There was quite a bit of discussion about whether or not that actually is going to restrict any new homeless services in the city, and the mayor was pretty straightforward with us, saying that that he wants to have new services in the city, that he believes that we are not a concentrated area of homeless services, and that there's opportunities for additional homeless services in the city of Santa Cruz.
Uh-huh. So it looks like we have about a minute left here before Uncle Dennis, who is already usurping a minute of my time.
And you'll be going from the cream to the...
To the dregs, yes. It's always the way it is at this time of night. But Uncle Dennis
My best Uncle Dennis, as always.
He's got his booze with him and his questionable 40-year-old discs, but...
That sounds like where I should be.
The Quicksilver Messenger Service is coming your way soon. And I could,
Quicksilver Messenger Service?
I'm sorry. It's the old geezer version of the Quicksilver Messenger Service, yes. It's more of like the slow Quicksilver Messenger Service. Anyway, Steve, thank you again. If people want to reach you and complain about disability discrimination out of the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which I understand is one of the concerns that some people have, what should they do? What number should they call?
Well, they can reach me at 466-6078, and I'm sure that maybe you mentioned Dr. John Colby and his efforts on behalf of a couple of the folks who have seemingly been denied services at Homeless Services Center, not necessarily based on a disability, but certainly facing challenges with disabilities and trying to get services. So you might want to be able to have people reach John, who's doing really good work right now.
Good idea. If people want to reach John Colby, do give me a call at 423-HUFF. 423-4833. Though, frankly, I'm not as accessible as you are with your constant cell phone ever eating away at your brain. So, again,
the people can call me and I can give them John's email. I'm sure you'd be happy to hear from me.
Very good, Steve. And I wish you well in your campaign to spread the word, even if it means alienating the entire shitty council and the electorate. And, of course, we know, of course, you are a shoo-in to win if only somebody gives you $100,000.
That's all I need.
Exactly. Thank you,
Steve. A thousand a day is all we have. Anyway, good talking to you, Robert. Take care.
And we'll see you tomorrow in court, perhaps, at 8:15 with the Santa Cruz 11.
All right. Look forward to it.
All right, man. Bye-bye. That is about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. As usual, that booming voice in the
background
is none other than our favorite intrusive broadcaster. Hang on a second.
Tell them about our benefit.
The Angry Samoan. So I think you as an honorary Samoan, can...
No. You
want me...
I want you to go on Samoa.
You want me to go to Samoa? Critic
keep
of...
Samoa talking.
Samoa talking, yes. Well, this is Friday, June 15th coming up. That's a week from tomorrow. It's a benefit show for Freak Radio Santa Cruz. That's a radio station you may have heard of. However weak the signal and pathetic the transmitter is, that is...
Hey, it's more than we had a week ago.
It was a week ago, and it's stronger than a week ago, so that's good. Uncle Dennis has to be blamed for this latest activity by actually daring to put the station back on the air in its pathetic, disabled condition.
In time for your show.
In time for my show, which, of course, is the one high spot of the day here on Free Radio. So check it out. It's got all kinds of exciting bands, Rat Bastard, Mental Disaster, other pretentious names, angry Samoan. Can't these people can't think of something a little more genteel? For heaven's sake, whatever happened to, I don't know, Jefferson Airplane? I guess that's coming up on your show, perhaps.
Well, Jefferson Starship?
Oh, no, that's a little too advanced for me. I'll be back on Sunday.
No, that's not true.
It is true, unfortunately, Dennis. Sunday at 9:30 in the morning. I'll perhaps be reading that glowing letter you wrote to D.A. Bobley, or was it to the judge, suggesting...
Well, to whom it may concern.
To whom it may concern, suggesting that our little illicit relationship will now be exposed for all the world to see. I commend you on your bravery there. I don't. Actually, I am going to be...
you know what's brave, Robert?
What's that, Dennis?
The sitting in the chair that you've just sat in for 2 hours.
I won't comment on these kind of derogatory comments. I'm used to them, folks. They kind of roll off my back like poo-poo off a goose, or I don't know, is it poo-poo through a goose? I don't know. Anyway, thanks for being with me. You want to call me off air, you can try at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Check the Huff website if you want to get some of the background. HuffSantaCruz.org is the place to go. And in the meantime, you're stuck with Uncle Dennis, and from the cream to the dregs. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrobe Spears Broadsides.